From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
Nobody had ever called me creative, and I didn't come from a family where that was a pursuit in and of itself. It was nice, but that wasn't where you headed. So the whole thing kind of intrigued me.
Gigi Pritzker was born into billions. She's a member of the wealthy Chicago Pritzker family, but she didn't plunge headlong into the movie business. She's produced and helped finance lots of movies, but she'd never done TV until she started to develop a film based on the life of Albert Einstein and found that it demanded to be a series. Pritzker's first series, Genius, was also Nat Geo's first scripted program, and it's in the Emmy race with 10 nominations. She talks about moving from film to TV and explains what convinced her to sign on to last year's Oscar-nominated Western, Hell or High Water. But first on the news banter, Disney throws down. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my colleague in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hello.
So the big news this past week or so has been Disney's announcement that it is moving to streaming. They are going to have two services sometime in 2019. One will be sports, but I will note, not your NFL or NBA games, at least not yet. The other will be content. Disney, of course, has so much content. Pixar, Disney Animation, ABC show, whatever, so much stuff. But it is not clear at this point whether they're including a few minor properties like Star Wars and the Marvel movies. Having said that, nonetheless, you know, this has gotten everybody paying attention because it feels that the biggest generator of successful media right now is acknowledging a future that is coming faster than we can sort of seem to digest it.
Yeah, this is huge. This is, I think, one of the more significant developments of the past 5 to 10 years in the entertainment business is Disney finally committing to this, because we've already seen other companies dip their toe in this. CBS has its All Access service, and there's a Comcast initiative with FX and some other networks turning these linear channels into over-the-top networks. But Disney getting into it, it's the biggest media company in the world. They have the biggest and most powerful franchises. This is a gigantic step.
And I should mention that they're going to be pulling their content from Netflix. So Netflix is, of course, now, the studios like to say it's a frenemy. Like, they are a huge competitor now, but at the same time, they buy a lot of content that the studios up until now had tended to think of as old played out stuff like Gossip Girl or Friends or old series. But it turns out that by having sold this stuff to Netflix, they built Netflix into this gigantic entity that it now is. And I think what you're seeing is with Disney and head of the pack, they're starting to pull this stuff back. And I think you're going to see competitors follow because they are trying to say, enough is enough. We are the studios and you, Netflix, we're not going to try to help you anymore.
And Netflix has known this day was coming. Even this past week, they made some significant announcements about initiatives like buying a comic book publisher, Millar World, because they want their own IP. They just made a deal with David Letterman to bring him back. And this entire original content push that Netflix has been making over the past 2 years to own more of their content is because they know at some point ownership is what matters. And a company like Disney can pull its content whenever it wants. The overarching question here for me is, at what point are consumers going to stop paying for these additional services? Because if you look at what Disney is likely going to offer, I mean, they haven't set a price point and they haven't really given many details about what this will be, but we're seeing this fragmentation of digital streaming services where they're asking consumers to pay extra. CBS All Access costs an extra $10, and, you know, Hulu costs an extra $10. And all of these different things are going to start adding up. And I don't know how much more the consumer can bear if they're also taking on a cable subscription. I think that, you know, one or the other is likely going to be sacrificed.
Well, as we see, there's a trend towards cord cutting, which will probably accelerate for many reasons. And Disney right now is trying to sort of poise itself in the middle. You know, they will continue to offer like, for example, the NFL games and the NBA games, if you are a cable subscriber. And if and only if you're a cable subscriber, you'll see those games on their app. So I do think they're trying to straddle now, knowing that cable is still a source of a lot of money, and yet they see streaming as the future.
Yeah, I think for now, that's the strategy. I mean, Les Moonves at CBS basically said exactly that. He said that CBS thinks that they can have their cake and eat it too, which means that they're going to have the linear channel CBS, and they get a ton of retransmission fees from the cable operators. And then they're also going to have this additive service called CBS All Access, which is people are going to pay for to get additional content and the library. That, I think, will work for now, but I don't know in the future if we're just going to move to a universe where all of these digital services become the new cable bundle and the cable bundle goes away, or whether they're going to peacefully coexist in some way. I don't know the answer to that.
I do think that what you have is a situation where, you know, the deck is getting reshuffled. I'm almost sure now that AT&T is buying Time Warner, assuming that closes, that they will launch something too. They have named this veteran AT&T executive, John Stankey, to oversee Time Warner, which will be renamed. I mean, Warner Brothers will still be Warner Brothers, but Time Warner will not be called Time Warner. They have not yet revealed the new name. And this is a guy who comes from, you know, metrics and data. He is not a guy who loves content. I interviewed him this week, and he said he was trying to work watching stuff into his schedule, his work schedule, and yet he doesn't have a list of shows that he could kind of came up and said he had watched Downton Abbey with his wife because they both liked it. But, you know, that is not exactly a guy who has a passion for content. But then again, you know, his job is to make sure that when all of these ways of watching on their your tablet, on your cell phone, on your actual old-fashioned screen, when all of that is somehow sorted through, that AT&T will be in the game.
Yeah, you had a great interview with Stankey this week in Hollywood Reporter where you asked him a lot of these questions about, you know, what are the plans for content? And I think his answers, at least, you know, we'll see if he actually follows through, but his answers, I think, will give a lot of people in Hollywood a sigh of relief. He said, A, that AT&T is likely going to invest in content for Time Warner and increase spending on content. He said that he is not the kind of person who's going to get in there and start micromanaging which movies to green light. I think people at Warner Brothers likely would appreciate that. He would get involved if they're going to spend $200 million on a movie, but he wouldn't decide which of the movies to do, but more positioning himself as someone who can be additive and give more opportunities for distribution and promotion and data research and all of these other things that AT&T can bring to the core content creators, and not pretending that he knows how to create good content.
Yeah, I think that's smart, although I do say that whenever anybody comes in to buy something, you should take their words with a large chunk of salt. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. The production company Oddlot Entertainment has made or invested in quite a range of projects in recent years, including the coming-of-age dramedy The Way, Way Back, the film adaptation of the sci-fi novel Ender's Game, John Stewart's directorial debut, Rosewater, and last year's Best Picture nominee, Hell or High Water. In that movie, Chris Pine and Ben Foster play a pair of brothers who turn to bank robbery in drought-stricken, post-recession West Texas.
Maybe we should hit another branch.
You know, you talk like we ain't gonna get away with this.
I've never met nobody got away with anything, ever. You.
And why in the hell did you agree to do it?
Because you asked, little brother.
Oddlot's founder is Gigi Pritzker, and film production is just one division of her company, Madison Wells Media. It also has projects in virtual reality and live theater. It's been a good year for Pritzker. Hell or High Water was in awards contention, and so is her first TV project, Genius, which in its first season focused on the life of Albert Einstein. It has 10 Emmy nominations, including Outstanding Limited Series. If Pritzker is a familiar name, it may be because the family is ranked by Forbes at number 7 on its list of America's richest families. Her father, Jay Pritzker, created the Hyatt Hotel chain with his brothers. Gigi Pritzker could have gone into any number of family businesses, but when she spoke to us from her hometown, Chicago, she said she knew in college she didn't want to do that. She wasn't planning to get involved in Hollywood either.
I didn't think I would end up here. I didn't start here. I was headed to Nepal, where I lived in college, and I was going to get a master's in anthropology and go back to Nepal and work at an NGO. I had a whole different plan. And then I took a right turn and went to film school.
Why? What happened?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It is the power of a teacher. I had a professor who decided to take it upon himself to tell me my plan was flawed and I shouldn't get a master's in anthropology. And instead, I should go to film school, which was mind-boggling to me because that was never in my mind.
I'm trying to figure out what he saw in you that made him think film school.
Well, I asked, and I said to him, wow, A, you're an anthropology professor telling me not to go into anthropology, and B, why film? So he said, because anthropology will lead you to academia, and academia will drive you crazy because you're too creative. Mm-hmm. And nobody had ever called me creative, and I didn't come from a family where that was a pursuit in and of itself. It was nice, but that wasn't where you headed. So the whole thing kind of intrigued me when he started to describe how he saw me and my future layout. And, you know, you're 22 or whatever, and he laid out the pieces of it for me, and I thought, okay, so I'll go do that.
So when you come into this town, I mean, just walk us through a little bit because, you know, Hollywood wants to smell money. And I'm not analogizing you to Megan Ellison, except in the respect to ask a question. Her father lined up advisors and tried to, you know, give her some perspective on not just coming in and you know, she invests her own money. Your strategy, I'm assuming, was very different, but I'm hoping you'll just tell us how it worked.
Yeah, so my strategy was a non-strategy. I am the youngest of five kids, so I think that builds a real tenacity. And as my mother would say, I am rebellious. So I wanted to kind of do it my own way. And I knew coming from where I came from, I would never in my own skin feel competent and capable if I didn't understand the product deeply. So I spent many, many years building a company that did corporate films. You know, I made a 30-minute employee communication for a caster company. I mean, it was as unsexy as humanly possible. And I would shoot them and edit them and put them together, and we did hundreds of them. And in the process, we were making, wasn't great art, but it was the nuts and bolts of making filmed communications. And so we did commercials and music videos and all the rest. And that company became very successful, and my partner and I made more money than we thought we were going to, so we invested in a script. And so we kind of eased into this side of things in a very different manner. And now, fast forward 30 years, I think the nuts and bolts of understanding physical production and having had to edit on a half-inch machine and do all the things I did in my 20s really helped a lot. And so, yeah, I do approach it from a very different place.
So then you start making just quite a range of films, and you were not thinking about financing these on your own. You were looking always to do this as a business, if I understand you correctly.
Correct. For a number of years, I made money making these things. and at some point, my father, it was very interesting, said to me after a few years, he came to New York where I was working, and he said, well, this is great. You've really like done a great job and you've built this business. And so now you should come work with us and do, I don't know, something completely different. And I said, but I want to do this. I like this. And he said, well, you know, it's the basics of any company. Like you build another company. And I said, no, the storytelling piece of this is what I love. And that's what was interesting to me.
So when you made Ender's Game, I think you were quoted saying you thought Hunger Games had cracked the code, which I'm taking that to mean, you know, that you thought that what the YA, the young adult thing was mm-hmm. figured out, but then it wasn't figured out.
Yeah, exactly. You know, actually, when I look back on it now, Ender's Game for me was my attempt to create franchise for myself and to really start the beginnings of this idea that has become Madison Wells Media, because Ender's Game, there's a lot of life left in Ender's Game. We have not seen the end. There's television opportunity. There's virtual reality opportunity. There's lots of different ways to express that story, and we are in the midst of looking at a number of them. So for me, you know, there's world building like Ender's Game, and then there's singular movies like Landline or Way, Way Back or Hell or High Water.
So when you come in to do a project, and you've done a variety of things, you know, you mentioned the Way, Way Back, and then you had Jon Stewart's film Rosewater.
Yeah.
Do you come in generally through the same entrance, or are you approached to finance? How do you participate in these films? Because obviously producing can mean all different things.
Yeah, absolutely. My mother still doesn't understand what I do. It happens in a multitude of ways. I would say Ender's Game I willed into existence. Way, Way Back came to us. It's all different manner of thing. Landline, which is out now, is a movie that one of our executives saw Obvious Child at Sundance and said, wow, this is a voice that is extraordinary and we want to work with this woman, Gillian Robespierre and Liz Holm. And so we did. And on basically a three-word pitch, we said, yes, let's figure this out. So it, you know, it happens in a variety of ways.
Right. So with Hell or High Water, for example, I know CBS, the film studio, released it. Did they buy it? I can't remember if they bought it at a film fest. I can't remember how they came to be in Hell or High
they
Water.
They came in early. They were supportive early on and were our studio from the beginning. And our participation in Hell or High Water came as a result of a relationship with Sidney Kimmel, who had really been struggling to put the movie together for a number of years, which, you know, is always funny because when you see the end result, you're like, that was awesome. That, you know, that
how was that
been
hard?
A slam dunk.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. How was that hard? And yet, so we came on board to that movie, not day one, you know, day before production, but not in the beginning of their journey. Sidney Kimmel really carried the water on that for a long time.
So it's just different horses for different courses. I mean, with Jon Stewart, let's just do one more and say, how did that come to be?
That one was amazing. I got the script early on. I read the script and I called the agent and said, I will get on a plane today and go to New York and talk to Jon. I will do anything to do this movie. Because to me, it was so well written, such a great script, and Jon is so talented. And I think that story is, you know, an important story, and I wanted to be a part of making it happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's do you have any, I don't know, you know, it didn't break out, and Hell or High Water did. When do you start to have a sense that this one's going and this one isn't? Or do you go right up to the moment of the premiere and think, I don't know?
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I think there's a mercurial aspect to a lot of it, too, because it doesn't always make sense necessarily. But I will say Hell or High Water was, I think, it hit a moment that was a really important moment. And I think the movie very much portrays kind of where our country is in a lot of respects. And to me, yeah. I mean, there's a scene, spoiler alert, when the the big bank robbery happens. And they run out of the bank and the entire town is armed and shooting at them. And if you are on the right side of the spectrum of our political lines, you say, yeah, see, that's why we all need guns. And if you are on the left side of the spectrum, mm-hmm. you look at the same scene and you say, oh, my God, this is why we got to get rid of guns. And to me, that's the power of the visual medium. And the shame of it is that we aren't having these dialogues. But I, in a very calculating way, wanted to show that movie to mixed audiences because it did provoke conversation that I think is important to have.
Coming up after a short break, producer Gigi Pritzker tells us why it may not be that easy to do a season on a woman genius. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Madison Wells Media CEO Gigi Pritzker. She's an executive producer of the Nat Geo anthology period drama Genius. The first season focused on Albert Einstein. Next up for season two will be Picasso. Genius is nominated for 10 Emmys, including Outstanding Limited Series. Actor Jeffrey Rush is in the race for his performance, and Ron Howard is nominated for directing. The series is based on Walter Isaacson's Einstein biography and jumps back and forth in time, showing Einstein as a desperately bored university student, as well as a renowned fuzzy-haired genius forced to flee Germany as the Nazis rise to power. One of the first scenes in the series shows the older version of Einstein engaging in some extracurricular activity with his secretary, Betty, played by Charity Wakefield.
Betty, move in with me.
You have a wife.
Whom I adore.
You're insane.
No. I'm quite rational, actually. I love Mozart and Bach. I love the Swiss Alps and the Baltic Sea. Why can't I love you and Elsa?
For a man who is an expert on the universe, you don't know the first thing about people, do you?
Pritzker spent years trying to make a film about Einstein, but she found that project wasn't working until it shifted into television. This was new territory for her, as well as for a lot of other players in the series.
You know, it's Nat Geo's first foray into scripted. It's Ron Howard's first, long time directing television. It's a lot of firsts for a lot of people. And the other thing I love about it was a lot of women that made that whole thing happen. It was Rachel Shane and I bringing it to Imagine, where Francie Calfo and Anna Culp were. They championed it and got it to Ron and Brian. Ron signed on to want to direct
it. Ron Howard and Brian Grazer. But
yeah.
Yes.
And then it ended up Nat Geo, which Carolyn Bernstein and Courtney Monroe championed it. So we joke that it was a lot of women that got Einstein on TV.
Well, and it turns out that Einstein liked a lot of women.
Yes, he did. In fact, that was one of the framing devices, was the women of Einstein. Was, you know, could you tell his story through the women that he was with at different times in his life?
Yes, you made sexy Einstein.
We did. We started with sexy Einstein. That really blew people away that the first scene was him and
first
his chalkboard.
Well, first you've got a killing, and you make it clear from the jump that this is not going to be a guy lecturing you about physics.
Correct.
So this is based on the Walter Isaacson book, and did you acquire the rights to that? Is that, trying to get to the genesis of it.
Yeah, it came to me. Our friends at Lionsgate had it and asked if I would take it on and see what we could do. And I spent the better part of 6 years trying to make it a movie, and it just kept not working. I was not happy with the script, and we kept writing and rewriting and new writers, and it was never the writer's fault. It suddenly dawned on me that it just wasn't something that fit a, you know, two-hour, three-act structure. And so it was when I started to rethink it as, you know, maybe it should be television, maybe it should be episodic, maybe it should be a different construct. And Rachel Shane had come to our company and we talked about it. And she went and found Noah Pink. And together we worked on structuring it and how it would look if it was episodic. And it just kind of flowed from there.
So when you approached this as a TV series and you hadn't done one before, how did you prepare for that?
It is very different. I learned a steep lesson. And you surround yourself with the most competent people you can find in that arena. And Ken Biller, who is our showrunner, is terrific and is doing the Picasso, our second season of Genius. And you find the best people who understand that platform really well, and they help you. And you know, for me personally, you got to kind of wake up to learn something new, which is really fun to me. So that's what this was. And we now have three or four other TV things that we're working on.
I mean, the thing I've heard about from people who go from film to TV is that the speed is the thing that is so different. And I don't know if that was your experience.
Totally. It's like drinking from a fire hydrant. But it's great because you can't be so precious about stuff. You know, I've had that experience because I do live theater as well and have done for many years. I used to own the Cornet Theater in L.A., So I've done theater for years, and theater is very different from film. So I understand the different platforms engage very differently.
So Picasso is the second one. Now, he was also a randy fellow. Were you looking for geniuses?
Yeah, well, you know, drug, sex, rock and roll sells. So, we got to have a little bit of everything in there. And he is an international figure, a universal figure. You know, those are the kinds of things that we're looking for because the Nat Geo is a global company and a global brand. So there are key things that they're interested in when it's their brand. So Picasso fits the bill. He just happens to be randy as well.
You work with a lot of women, as you mentioned and as I've noticed. You know, do we have a lady genius in the wings coming?
Oh, I hope so. Believe me, we've been working on it. And I think Nat Geo wants to as well. You know, it's interesting as you start going down that path. Women haven't had the opportunity and the platform and the breadth to be able to do certain things. So there are kind of snapshots of women who are fantastic and definitely deserve the genius status. But we also have to fit into the, you know, it's a business and we're in the business of global entertainment. So while there may be certain women in certain places at certain time, who has the breadth of a Picasso or an Einstein? But we're going to find her.
I'm going to find her, yeah. Now, you were written about your company some while ago in the New York Times, and they were talking about various production companies becoming very prominent and established. And they mentioned Participant, which is Jeff Skoll's company, Legendary, which was Thomas Tull's company, and Annapurna, as well as you. So Legendary is in this strange space now because it's owned by Wanda and we're not clear what's going on with Chinese money. Annapurna has gone out in a very risky way, as I've recently written about, to distribute. And Participant has a very deep-pocketed owner and they've got their arrangement with Steven Spielberg's company. You never thought about going into distribution, I assume, because I'm looking at this through the Darwinian lens of, you know, not that many on this list can necessarily thrive indefinitely. This is just too much money that goes up in flames if things don't go exactly right every single time. So did you ever look at distributing yourself and say, forget it? Or were you never even thinking about that?
I've looked. I've kicked the tires on lots of things and looked at different arrangements. But at the end of the day, the way we're constructing our company now, it's really about content. I got to think of a different word. But it's about stories and storytellers. And that's really what I want us to be. And I believe there's strength in that. And I don't have an interest in building to sell. I'm building for the long term. So I have a slow and steady wins the race kind of attitude. And we try things and we experiment within parameters. We're not going to do something that's going to bet the farm. And we build slow and steady. So I'm very much a just keep your head down and keep doing the work.
Gigi Pritzker is the CEO of Madison Wells Media and an executive producer of Genius on National Geographic. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.